Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order, Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Division, and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe. Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill.
I'm here.
Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward. Representative Zerwas.
Okay. I'd like a motion to approve the minutes of January 24th. Representative Frankie, would you make the motion?
Yep. So moved, Chair.
Okay, Representative Frankie makes a motion to approve the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we have the Board of Judicial Standards overview. Thomas, and if you would pronounce your last name and title.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Vasily, Executive Secretary of the Board on Judicial Standards.
Okay. Go ahead, sir, and sorry for me being late. I wanted to start every day at 10:15, and I was 4 minutes late. So go ahead.
I won't be long. We are the board that takes action on complaints against judges. We were created in 1974 based on an amendment to the Minnesota Constitution. The board has 10 members. The chair is Tim Gephardt, a member of the public, an insurance executive. The vice chair is Dakota County Judge David Knutson, a former state senator whom some of you probably know. The staff is small, consisting of me, a staff attorney, and my assistant. The board has 10 members, 4 members of the public, 4 judges, and 2 lawyers. The vast majority of judges in Minnesota are competent and ethical. However, if the board finds that a judge has committed misconduct, the board takes action. The board is the only entity that has that authority. It is essential that the public have confidence in the integrity of the judiciary. The board is independent. It's not part of the judicial branch. We have a comprehensive website that gives the public access to our decisions and how we operate. In serious cases, if the board finds a serious transgression of the rules, the board will file a petition with the Minnesota Supreme Court seeking suspension, removal, or in less serious cases, censure. The last serious case we had involved Judge Pendleton. You may recall that. He was an Anoka County judge who was living outside his district. Like legislators, judges have to live in the district in which they serve. Judge Pendleton was living outside the district, and he lied about it on his affidavit of candidacy. The board brought an action against him, and the Supreme Court removed him from office. That was in 2015. The board also can issue public reprimands. The most recent one was Scott County Judge Rex Stacy, who was publicly reprimanded for repeatedly berating litigants in court. In less serious cases, if the conduct is isolated and non-serious, the board will issue a private admonition to the judge. For example, one judge was admonished for not properly supervising his law clerk and paralegal. The paralegal was supposedly working from home, contrary to judicial branch policy. Records of all disciplines, including private admonitions, are kept until the judge dies. We also have deferred disposition agreements. They're like probation. If the judge has a problem such as demeanor, we'll work with the judge. Members of the board will meet with the judge and provide guidance and advice on how to handle matters. One note that I want to make is that the board reviews behavior, not decisions. Reviewing court decisions is the job of the Court of Appeals, Sometimes you may hear people saying that the Board on Judicial Standards isn't doing anything. And if you hear that, the most likely cause is that the person is complaining about a court decision, not about judicial behavior on the bench. And there's nothing we can do. If there's a court decision that someone doesn't like, it might be right, it might be wrong, but we don't have the authority to change that. Additional examples of conduct that we do take action on is in the brochure that's in your materials. Now, one function of our office and board that is not really visible to the public is our education and advisory opinion service. We go out and meet with judges. We attend meetings of judges, bench meetings. We participate in educational seminars, and we issue formal opinions on subjects that are that come up regularly. These are all posted on our website. And we also provide informal private advisory opinions to judges. Typically, the judge will call me on the phone with an ethics issue. I will research it, possibly consult with a member of our board, and issue the opinion, usually in writing, so there's no misunderstanding. And it's not just simply do this or don't do that. It contains research and citation to legal authorities. And that service has been growing in popularity. The number of advisory opinions that I've gotten, requests that I've gotten this year or in 2016, was more than 50% higher than in past years. So that's about it, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, members, any questions? Well, thank you very
thank
much,
you.
Sir. Next, we have the Guardian Item Board Overview. Suzanne Allegro and Lori Cusick.
Whichever one of you would like to begin, go ahead with your name and title. And
good morning, members of the committee, and Mr. Chair. I'm Suzanne Allegra. I'm the program administrator for the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. And thank you for the opportunity to present today. Since its inception in Minnesota, Minnesota Guardian Ad Litems have been committed to giving abused and neglected children a strong voice in court proceedings. A guardian ad litem is an advocate for the child whose welfare is a matter of concern for the court. While other parties in a case are also concerned about the welfare of the court, the guardian ad litem is the only person whose sole concern is the best interest of the child. The guardian ad litem is different from a legal guardian, and I often get questions from the public or calls about a guardian and conservatorship or a guardianship, and we do not handle those cases. We do not handle anything that involves money. The guardian ad litem also does not function as the child's attorney, nor do we provide direct services. The board, which was created in 2010, and I will give you a short history of the program, main purpose is to administer this program to ensure that we are independent and that we do advocate for the best interests of the child. The program, the guardian ad litem program, did start out in most counties, and then it moved from the county system to the judicial district system, and then also then moved in 2010 to the board. In 1999, the Supreme Court did promulgate rules of guardian ad litem procedure, which did provide standards for recruitment, selection, training, complaint processing, and oversight. And then, as I mentioned, in 2002, the board, the programs did move from the county system to the state, and also guardian ad litem staff, and costs became state-funded. The next major highlight happened when the Judicial Council in 2007 established what they called the GALAC Committee, and that was to look at long-term and systemic issues facing the program. And the two recommendations that came out of the GALAC Committee from the Judicial Council were to move the program out of the court system and place it under an independent board, and then to convert contractors to employees. At that time, the programs either had volunteers working as guardian ad litem, employees working as guardian ad litem, or independent contractors. It was decided, as I said, one of the recommendations to go from the independent contractor system to the employee system to provide better supervision. In 2009, the Judicial Council then did come over and seek legislation to establish the board. The board was appointed, and I was hired. In 2011, using the rules that the Supreme Court had promulgated, the board did review those rules and did promulgate program requirements and guidelines. We also, in the next couple of years, conducted a stakeholder survey. We did conduct an outside audit of the program's finances. We did do a cultural audit review. We recently, in 2015, revised the complaint process to provide for an appeal panel, and we are currently reviewing that process. And then in 2015, we developed a case management system. The enabling legislation for the guardian ad litem board is Minnesota Statutes 480.35, and there are several provisions in that statute. One does provide that the board is established in the judicial branch. However, we are not subject to the control of the judiciary. The board does have 7 members, 3 are appointed by the Supreme Court and 4 by the governor. In addition to who makes the appointment, there are other requirements in the statute for board appointment, including residency. At least 3 members must be from outside the metro judicial districts. There can be no active judge, no lobbyist, and of the Supreme Court appointments, 2 must be attorneys, and then also 1 must have previous guardian ad litem experience. The chair is elected by the board members, and the board has both mandated and permissive duties. The mandated duties are similar to other state boards, and the legislation was pretty much modeled after the State Board of Public Defense. The major duties are to approve and recommend a budget, to establish procedures for funding, establish standards, policies, and rules. Recently, the board did establish a case prioritization policy in response to our increased child protection cases, and with limited resources, the board did need to prioritize the cases. We also have a policy on fees. The board oversees the training requirements, and we have revised those over the year to expand the family court training. And the board does typically meet monthly in the metro area, but we have traveled to each of the judicial districts around the state, and you know, we do ask local judges to come to the meetings at that time. The program operates under both federal and state mandates for guardian ad litem appointment. The federal mandate began in 1974 when Congress enacted the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, or CAPTA as it's referred to. And this provides that a state, in order to receive federal foster care funds, must enact and enforce laws mandating the appointment of a guardian ad litem on every juvenile court case alleging that the child has been abused or neglected. This act has been reauthorized and amended over the years with bipartisan support. The following year, in 1975, the Minnesota legislature enacted the guardian ad litem statutes, and similar to the federal statute, the state mandates the appointment of a guardian ad litem on every juvenile case where a child is alleged to be abused or neglected. Minnesota also provided for mandated appointments in family court cases. Minnesota Statute 518.165 has 2 provisions for guardian ad litem appointment. One is for mandated appointment, which indicates that the judge must or shall appoint if there are allegations that the child has been abused or neglected. There's also another provision in 518 which provides for a permissive appointment where a judge may appoint if there are issues with custody or parenting time. We only assign guardians if we receive a judge's appointment order. And we do occasionally get calls, requests from the public requesting appointment of a guardian ad litem in a particular case, and we do need to inform the public that we only do appoint if there's a judge's order. The guardian ad litem duties are set out in statute, and the duties are the same whether the guardian services a family court case or a juvenile court case. And also the duties are set out in court rule. The duties do include conducting an independent investigation. The guardian would meet with and observe the children, either if they are in the home or if they're in placement. They do talk to people with knowledge of the child. They advocate for the child's best interests, including appropriate services, maintaining confidentiality, monitoring best interests, and providing written reports that include conclusions and recommendations upon and the facts upon which they are based. We, in 2004, revised our guardian ad litem report format to more clearly focus on the child. Just a few program, some program data for you. In FY16, over 17,000 children were served by the program. The current organizational structure is 10 guardian ad litem programs with one in each judicial district. The program does operate in all counties. Our breakdown is 246 employees with a total complement of 206.62 FTEs and 323 volunteers. We have a two-year budget of $30.5 million and about 7,500 active cases. This chart does provide the breakdown of the number of employees and the total FTEs, and one of the challenges certainly in providing services in every county in the state is to make sure that we tailor the number of employees we have to the caseload. And so while we do have a number of full-time employees, we do have quite a few, especially in outstate, part-time employees. Hennepin and Ramsey County, the 2nd and the 4th Judicial District, also use volunteers in child protection cases. Certainly, one of the big challenges.
Oh. Representative Hilstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the volunteers have the same training requirements as the employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, the initial training requirement for a volunteer and an employee is the same. It's 40 hours for juvenile court training. Everybody, volunteers and employees, are required to have 6 hours of domestic violence training. Additionally, the only difference is with the continuing education credits, employees are required to have 15 a year and volunteers are required to have 12.
Okay, questions, Representative Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait till the end for this question, but Representative Hilstrom kind of opened it up. Are guardian ad litems licensed clinical therapists?
Good.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, no, they are not.
Should they be conducting themselves as such?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I don't believe they should be representing themselves, and I don't believe they are.
I'll talk to you afterwards.
Okay. We should.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Go ahead, Ms. Allegro.
As I indicated, one of the challenges that we have dealt with, and similar to the other agencies involved in the child protection, and I did know you had a presentation from the courts, and they had indicated that the courts had, I think it was a 56% increase in child protection cases. We have also experienced close to a 60% increase since 2011. And the board has taken several steps to deal with the increase. We did get some additional permanent staff last year. We've utilized temporary staff. As I indicated, we do have a case prioritization policy that basically if resources are limited, that juvenile protection cases get first priority for assignment because of both the federal and state mandate, and then it would be any other mandated cases after that. One of the things that has occurred as a result of that, and this policy was sent out to all the judges indicating how the program would need to utilize its resources, is that basically since 2011, the family court assignments did stay relatively current or consistent, but then starting in 2014, when we did start to increase the child protection cases, We did decrease the number of cases that we are assigning to family court. So where we went from about 2,500 in 2011, last year we were down to about close to 1,500 cases. And the next slide is just basically showing you sort of where the child assignments are by judicial district. With Hennepin County obviously having the most cases. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the issues that the Guardian Ad Litem Board is facing. One of them, obviously, our most important one, is to maintain compliance with the federal and state mandates. And as I've indicated, we have taken steps to address that through how we assign resources, use of positions. One of the things we have done is we have converted also any administrative positions to guardian ad litem positions. So we are dealing with that in a number of ways. I shouldn't say every administrative positions. We have converted some administrative positions to guardian ad litem positions. We also want to ensure guardians perform their role consistent with statutes and are adequately trained. We try and do as much collaborative training as possible. For example, our domestic violence training we developed in conjunction with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We utilized the trainers from Department of Human Services for trauma-informed care, and we had all the guardians trained in that in 2015. The board wants to ensure that, as you know, safety and permanency are certainly the most important issues, or that a guardian needs to make recommendations, but also that we address the cultural, education, and special needs of the child. One of the things that we're, again, working on is making sure we're carrying out the duties in the most effective and efficient manner in order to best utilize resources. We recently had the National Center for State Courts come in, and they're currently talking to a number of the board, program staff, judges, stakeholders, to work on a service delivery model for us. If they had any recommendations in terms of efficiency and effective service delivery, looking at alternative organizational structures such as regionalization, more centralization, and better alternatives for supervision. The other issue that the program is dealing with, as I indicated in one of the slides, we have certainly cut back our presence in family court. And, you know, I know that some of the court is very concerned about this, that there does remain sort of an unmet and critical need for guardians to assist the court with custody and parenting time cases, especially where pro se litigants are involved. And the final issue that the board is also working on is, as I indicated, we revised our complaint process last year to provide an appeal panel for complaints, and we are in the process of reviewing how that change has either helped or not.
Representative Hilser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So guardian ad litems are appointed to children, but under the statute, children who are over the age of 10 have a statutory right to an attorney. Do guardian ad litems tell the children that they are entitled to a lawyer, or do they waive on behalf of the child's right to a lawyer?
Ms. Allegro?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think there's some, to be honest, I think there's some, I don't know if confusion is the right word, as to whose responsibility it might be to inform the child. We certainly, if the child makes the request to us, we would bring it to the attention of the judge. But I don't believe we are, I have Lori Cusack here from Hennepin County. She's the manager there, and maybe you could address what they do in Hennepin.
Yeah, in Hennepin County, Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Hennepin County, children over 10 are represented by the Children's Law Center. And so we do have children represented, and the judge will address that with the child. So they are aware of that.
I might add, as Ms. Pusick said, Children's Law Center is operating in Hennepin. They're operating in Ramsey. However, the practice may be a little different in other counties because Children's Law Center is not out in those counties.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been concerned, actually have heard that some guardians in some places across the state actually waive the child's right to a lawyer on their behalf. So I may have some legislation or some legislation may be coming prohibiting guardians from waiving that on behalf of the child. But that is an issue I care about very much, and I think you'll hear more about this session.
Okay, Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, I'm
just a second. Have you heard about that yourself? Has that been coming around? Have either one of you heard about what Representative Hillsman is talking about?
Mr. Chair, I'm aware of the issue of the representation for the children over 10, and I know there's a concern about that, and I think the board is supportive of attorneys being appointed. I've not been aware of guardians waiving on behalf of the child, and I will certainly look into that.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for bringing that forward. I also was concerned about that. I'm going to take it a step further. Are the guardian ad litems informing the children that they have the right to the lawyer instead of, I know Representative Hillstrom asked if they actually are waiving that right, which seems a bit unconstitutional, but are they actually informing them, and is that part of their training process?
Mr. Legro.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, no, they are not. As far as I know, as I indicated before, I think there's some, whether confusion is the right word, as to whose responsibility that actually is to inform the child, affirmatively inform the child. But as I said, what I am aware of, and I will certainly check out the waiving it, that when I've talked to the guardians, and if the child does indicate that they want a lawyer and they don't have one, they are bringing that to the judge's attention.
Mr. Chair. You know, when a child is between the ages of 10 and 18, it's probably better that multiple people are actually informing them of their rights. Mm-hmm. And I would ask that, you know, as we move forward, I know Representative Hillstrom and I might maybe working on the same legislation, I hope, but to proactively mm-hmm. inform them because they are juveniles. Right. And especially the closer they get to age 16, I don't know, they think they know everything and they don't. So they think they know that they should or shouldn't have a lawyer. I don't know, but I think it'd be better if multiple stops along the way that they would actually be informed of their rights.
I would agree.
Okay, continue on.
Mr. Chair, I'm done with my part of the presentation. So I do, as I indicated, I have Lori Cusick here from the 4th Judicial District, and I just wanted her to talk a little bit about sort of from a district's perspective what's kind of going on with child protection filings, and Hennepin County has especially, I think you've seen some of the stories, they have seen historic increases in the number of cases that the county is working with.
Ms. Cusa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk a little bit about the situation happening in Hennepin County. While the Guardian Ad Litem program supports the work of the Child Protection Task Force, Hennepin County has seen a historic increase in the number of child protection cases in our court. In 2016, the county fielded more than 21,000 child protection reports, double the number in 2008 and the highest number in recent history. These increases have put a strain on the entire system, but especially the Guardian Ad Litem program, who has not received additional funding to address these increase in numbers. The Hennepin County Guardian Ad Litem program does not have enough guardians to advocate for a child's safety and well-being on every child who comes into the system through no fault of their own. We currently have approximately 214 unassigned child protection cases, which translates into almost 500 children in Hennepin County not having an advocate or having their voices heard in court. While everyone can agree it's imperative to keep children safe, this requires systemic involvement, especially of the guardian, as their role is to advocate for the best interest of a child. They are solely tasked with looking after that child's needs and welfare during this most vulnerable time. Guardians are the only person within the court system who interact on a consistent basis with where the child resides, such as foster homes, family homes, schools, residential treatment centers, daycare providers, etc. The guardian forms a trusting relationship with the child, which allows them to openly communicate and share their fears and their wishes with the guardian. Guardians are often the most consistent adult in the child protection system and are also able to develop an understanding of this specific child's needs. These efforts allow guardians to share accurate and up-to-date knowledge of a specific child's needs with the judicial officer who is making life-changing decisions about where a child lives and who cares for that child's safety. These increased cases are not just an influx of easy cases. The cases we are seeing are as intense and serious as ever. One of our unassigned cases involves an 11-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl. The case came in due to the mother's chronic alcohol drug abuse. She is also diagnosed with mental illness, schizophrenia, and borderline personality disorder. The children are also diagnosed with a variety of physical and mental health issues associated with their mother's reported use while they were in utero. The children attended therapy, however, due to lapses in medical insurance, they are not currently receiving therapy. The mother was recently arrested with methamphetamines and drug paraphernalia in her car. It is reported that the mother abandons children sporadically at 2 to 3 days at a time, and the children continue to be placed with maternal grandfather. However, due to the mother's behavior and homelessness in the past, the children have lived in multiple locations with her. Parents suffering from chemical dependency plus mental health challenges are often very difficult cases. Long recovery times and high relapse rates are associated when these issues are occurring simultaneously. While the county social service is in charge of providing the custodial parent with the services to address these needs, and the court process is designed to monitor this progress, the children's sense of time can easily be forgotten. During this time when children are waiting for their parent to get better, they often become anxious and fearful of where they will go next and if their parent is actually going to get better. A guardian ad litem is responsible for knowing where their child is at in terms of dealing with this uncertainty and appropriately advocating for a sooner outcome with the court process. Additionally, within this matter, the children have significant needs which were not being consistently addressed. A guardian is imperative in ensuring appropriate services are in place and often finds out from the social worker, foster care provider, and school the assessments and services that need to be in place and will communicate these needs among the individuals involved. Often the guardian will ensure all of these important people within a child's life communicates with one another to streamline and ensure appropriate services are in place. No other party within the child protection system is able to easily access and bring together these important individuals, thus rightfully advocating for the best interests of children at the most basic level within this example. Grandparent foster parents are not often familiar with navigating complicated systems such as child protection and education. They often rely on individuals such as the guardian to lead them to where they can access resources, who to speak to, and how to best advocate for their grandchildren. Changing their role from caring grandparent to full-time caregiver can also be an enormous task and one where additional resources might be necessary to assist the children remaining with this caregiver. Guardians are often visiting children enough to notice this stress and have conversations with these caregivers to bring about change that will benefit the children. Another unassigned case involves a 10-year-old and a 4-year-old girl. Children witnessed domestic violence between their mother and their paternal grandfather where he choked her and threatened to kill her, resulting in police intervention. Mother acknowledged that she and paternal grandfather have a consensual sexual relationship. However, the oldest daughter reports the grandfather sexually abuses her mother. The girls have experienced an intense amount of emotional trauma and believe they are responsible for protecting their mother. Mother has a history of drug abuse and physically abusing her children. The girls have resided in 3 placements since this case opened: shelter, a mental health placement for one of the children, and a non-relative foster placement for both children. This mother has 2 other children to whom she does not have custody. These are very complex family dynamics and issues for the entire family unit. A guardian is another individual to assist the court in sorting through the needs that are first paramount advocating that those needs be addressed, then moving on to the next needs that are critical in mending the many wounds experienced by these children.
Ma'am?
Yes.
A question from Representative Hilstrom.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to go back to that first story. You identified that one of them was 11 and one of them was 8.
Yes.
So the guardians are not assigned in that case.
That's correct.
Did someone notify that 11-year-old that they were entitled to a lawyer, and do they have a lawyer if they don't have a guardian?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, what we have done in order to cover these unassigned cases is we have been sending either one of our supervisors or one of our guardians up to the court appearance, and they are talking with the parties that are there and trying to do the best they can by reviewing the file that we have, talking to the parties and getting a sense of where are things at and trying to make a recommendation at that point about best interest.
Representative Hilstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then at that point, is the child in the courtroom? So the judge actually gets to meet the child, talk to the child, or who waits? It's my understanding that there are a lot of these appearances where the children are not present.
That's correct.
So
if the judge doesn't see the child, the judge doesn't have the opportunity to tell the child they're entitled to a lawyer, there isn't someone that's there that's appointed as a guardian, who is making sure that the child's rights are protected? And if not, are you coming back to the board, the committee here to ask for additional dollars to actually meet the constitutional requirements that we have here?
Ms. Cusick.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, I believe that the judicial officer is taking note of that, and the Children's Law Center is there. It's my understanding and willing to take on these cases, even if there's not a guardian ad litem assigned.
Representative Hilstrom?
Mr. Chair, I guess maybe if there's going to be a budget hearing, is there going to be a budget request here to help fill the gap?
Ms. Kusek or Ms. Allegra?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, there is going to be a budget request for additional guardian ad litem positions. I think there's several. One of the issues is, which I don't know would necessarily involve budget, if the guardians do need to be one of the parties that lets the child know that they are entitled to an attorney. And I don't know if that would necessarily, we need to do that, we would do that. I don't know if that would necessitate additional staff. I'd have to take a look at it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have worked on these issues my entire time here in the legislature and actually spun off the Guardian Ad Litem Board to actually try to get some additional training and additional qualifications, and they have done a really great job. It's the job of this legislature to make sure that our most vulnerable children are getting the resources they need, because if we don't help them when we see them at first, we will see them again later. And we need to make certain that we are not creating million-dollar families by having these children start off in the system and then end up in the juvenile system and then end up in the criminal justice system. So I hope that we will hear some more advocacy about how to actually make it better so we don't contribute to this cycle.
Hey, Ms. Beckerson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To clarify, the Children's Law Center can help out in cases in Hennepin County. What happens to the rest of the state?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Children's Law Center, it's my understanding, again, they're in Hennepin and they're also in Ramsey County. And I think it's up to, and I'm not the expert in this, but I think it might be up to if the child does make the request for the attorney, I think it would be up to the county that the cases to provide the attorney. But it's, as I say, there's sort of one system for the metro area, and then it's a little different in the other areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, under the statute, the public defenders are charged with providing attorneys to children over the age of 10 years old. So in Hennepin and Ramsey County, the Children's Law Center has stepped in to assist in this area. However, it is the public defender's obligation to provide that services. It's the county's obligation to provide the lawyer to the parent. They're the ones that have to pay for that. And frankly, that has been a hard-fought battle for a number of years, but that's the way it's supposed to work.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will wrap up.
If you want to wrap up, we're going to get a bill and then another group in. So.
Okay. Okay, I will just finish by saying that I think it is so imperative that, as Representative Hillstrom talked about, that guardian ad litems are the eyes and ears of the court. They are the constant in these children's lives. They are committed to this, as our volunteers are. They are the conscience of the community that are brought into these cases that are now open in the court system. And I thank you for, you know, your time. And just know that Hennepin County, we are doing everything we can to cover as many cases as we can during this. But we are really going to be in need of help to make that happen. So I thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Allegro, Ms. Cusa. Appreciate it. Representative Smith, are you ready to present your bill? Okay, come to the table and...
Members, we have our first actual bill today, House File 46 by Representative Smith. Do you have any amendments for your bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is one amendment titled A2.
Chair will first move House File 46, recommended to be referred to the General Register. Chair will also move the amendment, which is,
what's it called?
A2 amendment, put the bill in the form that the author would like. If there are no objections, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is before us as amended. Go ahead, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, if we could we have some brief testimony from a supporter of the amendment?
Sure.
Thank you.
Go ahead and state your name and title and begin, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Amber Bouget. I'm the Hennepin County Chief Deputy Recorder, and I'm also the chair of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota County Bar Association. And the Minnesota County Recorders Association. And I'm here to thank Representative Smith, as well as the Minnesota State Bar Association and the Department of Revenue, for working with the Recorder's Office to amend the statute, so that this bill, so that it helps the Recorders, and the Recorders Association is in full support of this bill as amended. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This Bar Association real technical bill conforms statutes to existing practices and eliminates obsolete, inefficient, and unproductive recording practices. It also provides some necessary clarity for electronic recording. And I have Mr. Kevin Dunleavy to talk about a couple of specific portions of the bill that deal with your committee, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sir, your name and title, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I'm the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. The portions of the bill that are within the jurisdiction of this committee are dealing with Torrens proceedings. Torrens property is registered property, and there's two kinds of real property in Minnesota, abstract and Torrens. And everything starts out as abstract, and with abstract property, you go look at all the deeds back to the time of statehood to figure out who owns the property. With Torrens property, you go to court, and if you can get the judge to say the magic words, it becomes Torrens property, then it's like a car title. It's like a certificate of title for a motor vehicle, and the liens are on that motor vehicle title. So what we've done is we're trying to get the practices in the Torrens court, the Torrens referees. It's kind of like a probate referee, but it's a Torrens referee, and trying to get the practices to align with what's the existing practice today. So, for example, we're changing the appeal period. The statutory appeal period is 90 days, but the rules of civil procedure have a 60-day appeal period. So that's just a trap for the unwary. If you wait 90 days and the rules say 60, the Court of Appeals is going to kick you out. Then there's another, for the sake of judicial economy, we're amending the statute so that if there's a boundary line issue with Torrens property and abstract property, can do it all in one action instead of two court actions. So that's that, and fixing the appeal periods is the are the primary portions of this bill that I think that the committee would be interested in.
Is it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Representative Smith, anything else, any questions from the committee? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if this is testified by Representative Smith. So we're doing this to make it easier, to save money. How does this impact consumers at all and property owners at all, and how does it impact those individuals that facilitate transfer or contract for deeds and things of that nature?
The purpose of this is to make the system more user-friendly. The torrent system sometimes is a little clunky, and this is an effort to streamline it, make it easier for consumers and the title companies and the lawyers that work with it to try to make it work more effectively. As far as contracts for deed, it doesn't really address contracts for deed.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just closed on a house last week, and I was astonished at how much the cost for title search was. So am I going to see a reduction in title costs next time I go to sell my house, given inflation and all those other types of things? Or is this another way for title companies to actually put a little bit more money into their profits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the Bar Association, in conjunction with a number of other trade associations, is looking at ways to streamline the whole title system, which may eventually end up being a proposal to have all property torrents like this. Right now, about half of it in Hennepin County and Ramsey County's torrents. St. Louis County's got a bunch, Anoka's County's got a bunch. Stearns and Olmsted have less, and then most of the other counties have very little. We are trying to make the system work better for consumers, for everybody. I mean, I'm proud when I can come to the legislature and figure out a way for people to save money on attorney's fees because of what we do.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Smith? Oh, Representative O'Neill, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were in civil law, we had a question. I think Representative Howell might have had the question about the fee going from $50 to $10, and what did the counties think of that? And just wondering if you have that information back from the counties, that they'll see a slight drop in that fee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Association of County Officers, I believe, is in favor of that, and nobody gets the $50 condition of register. It's pretty much obsolete now. People just get certified copies when they want a copy. I don't even get certified copies anymore. I just order them off the Internet. That's even less than $10.
Okay, anybody in the audience want to testify in opposition? I don't see any. Representative Smith, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your support.
Okay. Chair will move the House File 46 be, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you.
And now we have Tax Court, Chief Judge Joanne Turner and Judge Brad Dallapena. If I screwed it up, go ahead and correct it. Whichever one you'd like to begin, state your name and title, and go for it.
Well, I'm temporarily thwarted by technology here. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joanne Turner. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. And with me today is Judge Brad Dallapena, who joined the court with me in December 2012. We're here to talk with you today about three things: who we are, what we do, and why we do it. There are copies of our presentation in your packet. I'm going to start with who we are. We are an independent court within the executive branch, one of three such courts within the executive branch. We are independent in the sense that our judges do not report to any commissioner or other cabinet-level official, and particularly to the Commissioner of Revenue. We have been in existence in one form or another since the 1930s, but since the 1970s, when the court was reconstituted, we have been an independent court within the executive branch. And we are thus an independent and nonpartisan avenue of appeal for a taxpayer who disputes an assessment, a tax assessment, whether that's a property tax assessment coming from a county or an assessment of other taxes coming from the Commissioner of Revenue. We were specially established by the legislature to hear tax-related disputes, and our jurisdiction is limited to tax-related disputes. But within that limited jurisdiction, as you'll see, we handle an incredibly broad array of issues. We have three judges on the court. Each of us has special expertise in tax, and we must also have extensive experience in litigation because we are first and foremost a trial court. Two of the judges are here today. Our third judge, Tom Haluska, is committed elsewhere today. Tom's term in office ended on January 2nd, and he learned sometime after that that he would not be reappointed. I want to publicly thank Tom for his service, first to this country in the Navy, from which he was honorably discharged and in whose service he was disabled, to the people of Anoka County, whom he served for more than three decades as an assistant county attorney, and finally, to the people of the state whom he has served as a member of our court for more than 3 years. The governor's appointee to replace him is with us today, Ms. Tamar Granvall, who is sitting with our law clerks. Tamar is currently general counsel to the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Before that, she was a longtime assistant Minnesota attorney general, and at the end of her tenure, managed the attorneys who represent the Commissioner of Revenue in cases before us. Tamar will be sworn in later this spring, and we're grateful that she could find the time to come and appear with us today. In addition, we've got three staff members, a paralegal who manages our files, an administrative assistant who works with taxpayers, and a court administrator who schedules our hearings and manages our budget. And thanks to you, we have three law clerks. Two of them are here today, and I want to introduce them to you. Melissa Hotelling has a law degree from what is now Mitchell Hamlin. She joins our court after 10 years in private practice, during which she was voted a Minnesota super lawyer three times and one of the 40 best LGBT lawyers under the age of 40 in the entire country. Did you wave, Melissa? Next to her is Catherine Swanson. Catherine has a bachelor's degree summa cum laude from the U, a master's degree from the London School of Economics, and a JD from the University of Washington, where she was chief managing editor of the Washington Law Review. After law school, she clerked for the Alaska Supreme Court and then was an assistant Alaska Attorney General, where she handled complex tax matters, including taxation of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. And our third law clerk is committed elsewhere today. Jenny Push is a magna cum laude graduate of Gustavus Adolphus, where she played varsity hockey. Earned her law degree from Wisconsin-Madison, where she was managing articles editor of the Wisconsin Journal of Law, Gender, and Society. And after graduation, she worked for a time as a tax consultant with Deloitte in Milwaukee before joining our court in the fall of 2015. And if you're wondering how our little court in a flyover state can attract talent like that, it's, number one, thanks to you for funding it. And we are one of the hot tax clerkships in the country right now, second only to the U.S. Tax Court. So that's who we are. What do we do? 95% of our caseload. I'm sorry.
Representative Councilman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why are we so hot?
Well, it's a small numbers problem. Part of it is because we are one of the few independent tax courts in the country. Also, we have some of the broadest jurisdiction of all tax courts in the country. There are other tax courts in other states, but they have, in some cases, much more limited jurisdiction than we do. We handle there isn't really a tax in the state that we can't hear a case about, and that's part of the attractiveness. And also, you know, frankly, living here.
Sure. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. 95% of our caseload are appeals from property tax assessments brought by taxpayers. These properties are range in scope second only to the range of properties in the state. In other words, if it's real property and it's in within the state borders, we can hear a case about it. So in the 4 years that we've been there, we've heard cases involving department stores, shopping centers, single-family residences, timberland. Judge De La Pena heard a case involving the Ford Motor Plant in here in St. Paul, about which you've heard so much. Warehouses, big box retail, residential building lots. I'm in the process of valuing an ethanol plant in southern Minnesota, and the Sartell Paper Mill, which exploded a few years ago, and that involves valuing a hydroelectric plant. We have a parking ramp case in front of us. Again, if it's real property and it's located in the state of Minnesota, we can be asked to value it. The vast majority of those cases involve disputes over assessed value, but that's not all of the issues that can be raised about those properties. We can also hear challenges to their property classification, which determines how the property is taxed, and whether the property is taxable in the first place. Most of these tax cases are eventually settled. 99.9% of them will settle. But if they don't settle, we hear motions by phone to reduce costs and be convenient for the parties, and we will try the case anywhere the parties can agree. So we hear cases in all 87 counties. Trials in those cases are to the court. They're to a judge and not to the jury. And again, we'll travel to wherever the parties agree to hear the case. The rest of our docket are appeals from orders issued by the Commissioner of Revenue. They are a small but constant part of our docket. I'll show you some numbers in a minute. And those issues range, again, from residency challenges, state sales and use tax. Any tax administered by the Commissioner of Revenue can come before our court. Our court is the only practical avenue of appeal for a taxpayer who's challenging an order from the Commissioner of Revenue. Although the district court can hear those cases, the taxpayer has to pay the tax first, along with penalty and interest, and then sue for a refund. And for most taxpayers, that's just out of reach. So, examples of some of the cases we've heard in commissioner appeals in the last few years: whether an individual is liable for sales and use tax against, assessed against a business in which they may have been employed or had an ownership interest, whether a taxpayer can claim a theft loss deduction for funds misappropriated from an IRA, whether a return commission, Mr. Chairman.
Could we get a question from Representative Howell, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question goes to, how do they go about getting in front of you? Is there a cost involved, and how is that process done? Do you want to wait till the end to answer that, or is it now a good point?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer that now. Are you talking about the Commissioner of Revenue side or property tax?
Because
it's different.
Mr. Chair, if they could lay them both out.
Sure.
Judge,
Mr. Chair, on the Commissioner of Revenue side, they file the appeal directly with us. It's a one-page form, one-page fill-in-the-blank form. There is a filing fee. If the taxpayer receives any form of government assistance, they're considered in form of pauperis by state statute, and they don't have to pay the filing fee or any out-of-pocket cost. Our filing fee is the same as it is for a district court case, which is about $310. For a small claims case, of which there are jurisdictional limits, the filing fee is only $150. And I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a minute. Our property tax cases are right now filed with the district court administrators in the 87 counties. The district court administrator is then supposed to notify us that the case has been filed so that we can then enter it into our docket system. And The filing fee, again, there is the same as the district court case, $310 roughly. If the taxpayer wins, that's a cost or disbursement that they can then be awarded and recover from the taxing authority.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what happens to the point where they file for tax court and before the case is heard, the Department of Revenue decides to, and tells them to go home, they're not going to push the case any further? What happens to that filing fee at that point?
Judge?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the parties are always perfectly able to settle the case at any time. Once the case is before us, it's not a Department of Revenue matter anymore. It's the taxpayer's appeal, and the taxpayer's in the driver's seat. So if there's a point at which the taxpayer decides they don't want to pursue the appeal anymore, they can resolve the matter with the commissioner or they can just walk away. But they don't get the filing fee back is the short answer, unless they win at trial and can recover that as a cost or disbursement. Now, the filing fee is the only fee they pay. We don't charge for a motion filing, for example, like the district courts do. It's $310, period. If they want to appeal, they would have to pay for transcripts. But, again, we don't charge a motion fee. We don't have other filing fees. It's that fee and that fee alone.
Okay. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably pretty easy question. What's the timeline on this from the time something comes up for both paths? How much time are we talking about people waiting or investing in this?
Judge?
On the property tax side, we got behind during the recession with filings. And so we're in the process now of issuing scheduling orders for cases that were filed with us for taxes payable in 2015. We're going to get caught up. We're going to get caught up in about the next 6 or 8 months here. And getting caught up means that the cases then are going to be scheduled for trial in about 15 months. Those are for regular cases. For small claims cases, we issue a scheduling order that says contact us within the next 30 days to pick a trial date. And that's true for both the Commissioner of Revenue cases and on the property tax side. Those cases are going to come to trial very quickly. On the Commissioner of Revenue side, because there is so much process that goes on within the Department of Revenue before the case gets to us, we will get the parties on the phone as soon as the case has been filed and the Commissioner has filed an answer. And in many cases, the parties will tell us they're ready to try the case. And that we just, while we're on the phone together, we'll schedule the hearing. Sometimes the parties will tell us they need some additional discovery. Sometimes we have taxpayers who think that the Department of Revenue is holding out secret documents, for example. And if the parties want discovery, then they'll agree to do that and we'll accommodate the request. But also keep in mind that on the property tax side, if the property value, the assessed value is decreased during our process, the taxpayer gets interest on that. But to a certain extent, doesn't have to pay interest if there's a decrease. And I know of several cases statewide in which the taxpayer has refused to sign a settlement agreement because the interest they're getting from the county, that interest rate is so good. It's post-judgment rate, and it beats anything they can get anywhere else. So in that respect, the taxpayer is protected in the event of delay.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were talking about appeals from commissioner orders and the broad scope of those appeals. Those appeals are a much smaller part of our overall caseload, but they are much more likely to go to trial because, again, the Department of Revenue is able to resolve most of those disputes before they ever get to us, and that just means that the cases that get to us are the ones that are truly intractable, where somebody just needs us to answer the question. The next slide in your packet talks a little bit about our workload. We prepare written findings of fact and conclusions of law and a supporting memorandum in each matter we decide. We issued a whole lot of those decisions in 2013 and 14 as Judge Della Pena and I were getting caught up. And since then, we're back to a somewhat more manageable docket. Also, we have issued in the past 3 years more than 750 unpublished orders in routine matters. consolidation orders, judge assignment orders, and more than 4,000 routine scheduling orders. The next slide talks about our caseloads. As you can see, between 2000 and 2010, our filings went up by about 450%, mostly all on the property tax side. That's just the result of property values falling statewide during the recession. Since then, they've leveled off at about 3,000 cases per year. That's still more than twice our historical average. Appeals in our commissioner cases are fairly constant. We run 90, 100, 120 of those a year. But, again, they take a disproportionate amount of our time because, again, they're much less likely to settle. Since this is sort of my annual report to you as a committee, we want to report to you on the initiatives we undertook this biennium and look ahead a bit to the next biennium. During 2016-17, you gave us money for five initiatives, one of which was to hire a third law clerk, and you've met her. We also got some money from you to update our website, and I can report to you that that's been done. We have now a modern website with a tab that allows taxpayers to search our decisions to see how we've ruled on matters in the past and be able to do some of their own research if they're unable to retain counsel or don't care to retain counsel. We also replaced our phone system to utilize VoIP. That's the state standard for long distance, and that project is complete. We're in the process of replacing our case management system. The contract for that project was signed on December 30th. The vendor is local. It's a division of Thomson Reuters headquartered here in Eagan, and they will be on site next week for 3 days to start the project. We still project to be able to finish that project by June 30th, which would be a good thing because unless we have Odyssey funds, that's when the money runs out. And finally, we're in the process of transitioning to Minit for all of our IT needs. There is some holdover. We are still using an outside consultant because Minit does not want to take on the project of taking care of our old case management system. It's just not worth their time for somebody to learn how to fix it for a system that's going to be obsolete in a few months anyway. If we look ahead to what we're planning to do for the next couple of years, we want to implement our case management system and extend it to electronic filing. For that, we'll need some minor statutory amendments, and we'll be looking to the legislature for those. We'll also need to update our procedural rules to accommodate e-filing and to make some other changes, some of which we talked to you about 2 years ago. You approved them, and they wound up in the ill-fated, star-crossed omnibus tax bill. So we're going to come back and renew those requests. We also want to update some statutory restrictions on post-employment practice from our court to reflect the fact that we now have law clerks who are with us for just a few years and then will go out and become tax practitioners. And finally, we will be asking to be exempted from the Data Practices Act so that we can better protect the confidential financial, tax, and medical information we receive from taxpayers and to allow us to protect the results of our own deliberations before the decision is issued. And we'll have more to say and more to talk with some of you about as those initiatives go forward. So that's who we are. That's what we do. The third part of our presentation is why we do it. And for that, I'll turn to Judge Della Pena.
I'd like to thank you for your time and leave you with a final point, which in a sense goes back to where we started. The tax court should be considered a critical part of Minnesota's taxation system. And I use the word taxation system rather than enforcement mechanism because the tax court's primary role is adjudication and not enforcement. The tax court was designed to be and functions as an independent check on the power of the state's tax enforcement agencies. Although our court resides within the executive branch, it functions. Yes, sir.
We forgot to have you give your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Brad Della Pena. I'm a judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. Thank you, Mr.
All right.
Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Although we are an executive branch agency within the executive branch, we function as an intra-branch check on the state's enforcement authorities. Bicameralism in this body and appellate review within the judicial branch are other examples of intra-branch checks, checks within the same branch. The tax court's independence of the governor and of state tax officials ensures that we have this independence. Once a tax court judge is appointed by the governor does not have removal authority. And the tax court exists to review final agency action. So with many administrative judicial bodies, the judges make recommendations to the ultimate decision maker. Here, the Commissioner of Revenue or local taxing authorities issue their final order, and those orders then come before the tax court. So we are not making recommendations to taxing authorities. We are reviewing their final actions, and we do so with that structural independence from both the governor and the taxing authorities themselves. That is what allows us to retain our independence.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the panel? Committee. Okay, thank you much for your presentation, sir.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Appreciate it coming in. Members, unless there's any questions, we'll adjourn.